Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
We're so glad you've tuned in to Leading Edge Medicine. Of course, it's Memorial Day weekend. We just want to wish you all the best this weekend. We've actually recorded the show in advance. We hope you're enjoying it, and we'll be back live with you next week.
Well, hello, ladies and germs, once more.
Ladies and germs.
Well, gentlemen, germs. You know, I know women that think they're pretty much interchangeable.
Seriously? I have never heard that before. This is the first time.
You've led a sheltered life, my dear.
But wow, that's all right. Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about brain function for
let's
a little bit.
Do
here,
it.
We've talked about breast cancer, we've talked about diabetes, and let's talk about brain function. You know, one of the things that goes downhill as we age is brain function.
Memory.
Memory, executive function.
Verbal fluency.
Ability, speed of processing.
Yeah.
Ability to
recall.
Short-term memory goes long before long-term memory goes, which is why Grandpa can tell you what he had for breakfast 49 years ago, but he can't remember where he's at today.
Yeah.
So, memory and cognitive function, in some respects, peaks when we're 17 years old. That's when our brain functions its fastest. Judgment sucks, but and impulsiveness is rampant. In fact, we don't develop real self-control and impulse control till late 20s to early 30s. So the brain is still developing through our late teens and through our 20s, which is why, you know, really our politicians are wrong when they set 18 as the age to vote and 21 the age to use mind-altering substances. Because 18-year-olds are too impulsive, too swayed by whatever comes down the pike this week.
Yeah.
They don't really use good judgment. They act on their impulses without considering the consequences, which is why young and dumb is pretty much a redundancy. And that plastic developing brain is easily damaged by mind-altering compounds such as marijuana. The younger you are when you start using marijuana, the more marijuana you use, the more frequently you use marijuana, the more potent the marijuana you use, your incidence of psychosis, overt craziness in which you are seeing things that are not there, hearing voices telling you to do things you shouldn't be doing, living in a total fantasy world that has no relationship to reality, becomes more and more common. I just saw an article recently that the FDA is considering reclassifying marijuana because it's popular and a lot of states are using it. And they've basically given the federal government the finger and said, we're going to do it anyway. And so the feds are saying, okay, then we're going to pretend that we led the way. We're going to decrease it as an offense. The problem is that when you tell people that it's acceptable, then they start taking the next jump that it's good or it's safe.
It's not dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, and we have too many people getting killed on our highways with just alcohol. And adding further causes to be inebriated and poor judgment and poor coordination on the highway is not something we really need.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we need to stop our children from using it, but I have digressed a bit. Speed of processing peaks in your late teens. Judgment peaks or finally gets there at about 30. But in your 20s, you have a fairly fast brain function and you have a brain that is flexible, assuming you haven't attacked it with drugs, that can change from one task to another pretty quickly. And we call this multitasking. Because you can, it's actually in medicine, we call it flexibility of attention.
Mm.
You attend to this, now you attend to that, now you attend to the next thing. And you can switch things pretty fast. But by our mid-30s, that's fading.
Mm.
And we have to start focusing on one job at a time if we want to do it well.
Right.
Yeah. And we are getting a little better judgment. But our speed of processing is slowing down.
Mm.
So we can't switch from task to task as fast. And we need to attend to that task. As we continue to age, our verbal skills start to decline. Our spatial orientation continues to decline. Our judgment in many aspects starts to go. Our memory starts to fade. We start remembering things that we solidified in our memory years ago. And we start getting more spotty about recent activities. Especially activities that don't have a great deal of importance for us.
Mm.
And that's why when you get a whim and you say, I think I'm going to look for that other pair of glasses, and you walk in the room and all of a sudden you don't know why you went in the room.
Right.
And it's why did I come in here?
Yeah.
Well, you see, finding those glasses is not a high import thing.
Yeah.
So your brain did not solidify that quickly, did not say, this you have to remember.
Yeah.
So it was a thought, you had it, you started to act on it, and it disappeared.
Yeah.
That very short-term memory processing is one of the first things to go. So if you find yourself having senior moments, if you find yourself walking in a room and wondering why, or trying to remember that old friend's name that you've known for 40 years and his good old what's his name?
Yeah.
What was his name anyway?
Yeah.
You know, what was the name of your first lover?
Yeah.
What, you know, where did you go for your honeymoon? Who knows?
Mm.
The fact is these things start to fade.
Mm.
And the more recent things fade, the fastest, the long-term things, you know, you'll probably remember where you went for your honeymoon for a long time.
Right.
You know, because A, it was important, and B, your wife will beat you about the head and shoulders if you don't. But our brains change.
Mm-hmm.
And this we call age-related cognitive decline. And in fact, there's another appellation. It's normal age-related cognitive decline. It's not a disease. It's not a bad process, according to our world, because it happens to virtually everybody.
Yeah.
Some people lose it faster than others. Some people, the decline starts younger than others. But it happens to everyone. 100% of the population have some degree of cognitive decline with age.
Yeah.
Well, since I run a business that is aimed at helping people function as well as possible, as long as possible, a year or so ago, I turned my attention to age-related cognitive decline.
Okay.
And so I started looking at why our brains are having this happen to them. And it turns out there are several reasons. But one of them is that acetylcholine, which is a chemical that we produce out of choline, which we get from our foods, acetylcholine is the primary neurotransmitter in our brain.
Mm.
Most of your brain cells use acetylcholine to fire and tell the next cell to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so those links of neurons firing in our head are highly dependent on acetylcholine to function. And it turns out that as we age, we make less and less acetylcholine.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of our decline with aging, the acetylcholine receptors on our brain are losing their sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And that combination of less and less sensitive acetylcholine receptors and less acetylcholine hitting our brain in the first place is a big part of why our brains are slowing down and losing some of our skill sets as we age. And that actually becomes quite noticeable for most people by 40, for a fair number of people by 35 or so, it's actually starting. So I said, all right, how do we raise acetylcholine levels in the brain? I mean, that seems to me that would be a reasonable thing to do. And indeed, there are studies that have used that. And raising acetylcholine levels in the brain will improve speed of processing, verbal memory, spatial memory, flexibility of our thought, our ability to change from this task to that task quickly. A fair number of our cognitive functions are improved by raising acetylcholine. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, we can't give you acetylcholine directly, but what we can do is we give people something called citicoline.
Yeah.
And citicoline is converted almost 100% in the body to acetylcholine.
Right.
And so by giving people citicoline twice a day, mm-hmm. we're able to reverse a fair number of those cognitive changes. But then we said, okay, what else is going on in the brain?
Yeah.
What else can we do to make those of us in midlife and beyond think better, faster, more accurately? Well, it turns out that blood flow in our necks is declining.
Yeah.
And it starts declining long before we have a critical flow problem. You don't get risk of strokes and serious cognitive problems from blood flow to that's more than 90% occluded.
Yeah.
But it turns out that if you measure the blood flow in the brains of people in their mid-50s, it is significantly lower than people in their 20s and 30s.
Mm.
It also turns out, though, that if you just add a very simple compound called resveratrol, you can increase the blood flow in the brain on a dose response ratio. So if 75 milligrams raises your blood flow, 100 will do it more, 150 will do it more, 300 will do it better than that. So it is a dose response.
Okay.
So if we start people on resveratrol
in
their 40s and 50s, we can actually start improving the blood flow to their brain.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Then we have to say, well, what else is going on?
Right. Why stop there?
Why stop there? Because, you know, biology is complex.
It is. And we know that multiple factors will affect every function.
That's right. Well, it turns out that membranes in the brain become less flexible.
Yeah.
The DHA that makes up about 80% of the weight of our brains stays DHA for a lifetime, but the flexibility, the ability for that to allow ions to shift in and out through that membrane declines with age.
Hmm.
And it turns out that there are two compounds which use together, zeaxanthin and lutein, which are normally given for vision, actually, to help your eyes. But in higher doses and over a longer period of time, our brain takes them up and improves the way our brains function because the membranes actually become more sensitive. Just as our retinas become more sensitive to light, our brains become more sensitive to thoughts.
Mm.
And so we put together a supplement that contains citicoline, lutein, zeaxanthin.
Okay.
Now, you might reasonably ask, why didn't you throw resveratrol in there? And that's because I made this supplement for men and women. But the study that showed that the resveratrol increased blood flow to the brain was only done in women.
Oh, interesting.
There were no men in the study.
Hmm.
Now,
that's unusual, isn't it?
It is, because, you know, but what they did was they were looking for issues of menopause and why menopausal women were getting brain changes and mood changes and so on. So they were looking at blood flow as one of the reasons that they might be changing.
Okay.
Well, it turned out that the study showed the more resveratrol you take, the better the blood flow to your brain. But we only have proof for women.
Okay. Fair enough.
My guess is, does it to us too.
Yeah.
That's why I take a lot of resveratrol.
I know you do. But it does other things as well, right? So
oh,
you
yes.
don't take it just for that.
I don't take it just for that. But it is one of the many reasons I You know, I take 1,000 milligrams a day.
And you've been taking it for a very long time.
Many, many years. But yeah. then I'm a very old man. So, you know.
No, well, what you're doing right now is putting together the memory component, but you've been taking resveratrol for a very long time.
Yes, I have indeed. So anyway, we have a compound that is for everybody over about 35 or 40.
Yeah.
I shouldn't even be talking about it yet because it's not on the market. It will be in about...
Teasing everybody, aren't you?
It will be in about 2 months.
Okay.
We've got it being manufactured at this very moment. We're notifying the FDA about it. We're getting ready. Hopefully, it'll be out here sometime in July or early August. And, so we're going to have something to increase cognition in essentially every man and every woman on Earth over about 35 years of age. And for the women, we will specifically say you ought to add the resveratrol. And for the men, I'm taking it too.
Okay. So, all right.
All right. So I think we've just killed another segment.
There we go. We
but
did
hopefully
indeed.
It was some useful information for folks out there.
Yeah, this is very important information, that's for sure.
I think it's time we shift gears a little bit. We're going to start doing some best of phone calls that
Sounds
have
good,
come
yeah.
in during previous weeks, months, and years.
Yeah.
As for those of you out there in listener land, you know, listen to the shows. I think you'll enjoy them. But mostly have a great Memorial Day and remember the young men and women who never got a chance to grow old.
Glad you're here on this Memorial Day weekend. Thank you for tuning in. Just a reminder, we're recorded this week, but we'll be live again next weekend.
Well, you know, there was a study published here just in the last week or so that kind of raised the eyebrows of every doctor in our clinic.
That's right. And I think they did what they were trying to accomplish. I think they were just trying to get media attention, and they got it.
They certainly did.
Their minute in fame.
Yeah, they were saying that people who did long-term fasts, only eating within an eight-hour period and then going 16 hours without food,
right.
had an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Which our doctors were saying, what the hell were they eating during that 8 hours?
Yeah.
You know, because generally, the intermittent fasting has been shown to increase all of the markers of longevity and to decrease risk of almost every disease around, including diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular risk. So it was a study that was a big outlier that showed just the opposite of what everybody else has been coming to the conclusion of.
Right. I mean, they haven't even concluded the studies. All they've done is collected data retrospective on two questionnaires from patients that they filled out. And so, you know, they haven't even done a study. It's just a retrospective analysis
That's
of some
right.
data for a questionnaire.
Where they have not really done anything prospective and put people on a program and followed them over time. So, you know, but you're right. It got clicks. It got people's attention. Mm. And it got so because it came up with a result just the opposite of what all the other studies actually have shown. Generally, intermittent fasting appears to be a good thing, and it's quite effective for weight loss if your total caloric intake is less. If you really pig out during the period in which you're allowed to eat, you're not going to lose any weight.
No.
In the final analysis, calories in versus calories out makes, you know, the basis for dietary control.
Yeah.
It's just that when you don't eat for a prolonged period of time, and if you're sensible about the times you do eat, you will generally lose weight. Most people do.
And as a general rule, during the time of fasting, your serum glucose is falling, and then what's happening is your insulin level is also falling. And that's what the goal is. And the longer you can fast, you go into different phases of this metabolic symptom, and autophagy is about 13, 14, 15 hours, and that's when the intercellular material is being cleared out, because the cells go, okay, no food coming in, 13, 13, 14 hours later. Let's kind of do some housekeeping. And they remove the damaged particles that we're collecting during the time of overeating.
Sure.
So it's the time when the body just cleans up and it goes into a cleaning mechanism. And that's what you're after. You're trying to see if you can get into autophagy frequently. Mm-hmm. And so some people will do, you know, maybe a prolonged fast a couple of times a week. Some will do it once a week. Some will do it as often as they can.
Yeah, and I generally eat breakfast about 6 a.m. I then have lunch anywhere between noon and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't eat again until 6 the next morning when, mm-hmm. you know, my wife comes up with my great little breakfast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm very comfortable with that.
And you feel good.
I feel good. And yeah. But, you know, if I wake up at 2 in the morning and my tummy is rumbling, I say, okay, burning fat, good.
Yeah. Yeah. You're making
sleep.
Growth hormone, right?
Yeah.
You're making growth hormone. What people don't realize is that's the time your body is mm-hmm. preparing itself to burn its own fat, to make its growth hormone. It's ready for fight or flight. So whatever comes its way, it's actually better to deal with it. And so that's when the prolonged fast basically stimulates ketosis. And what is ketosis? You're burning fat instead of burning muscle and sugar to provide you with the energy you need.
Yeah. I find it that I feel much better in the evening when I haven't had dinner, because I try to do what Dr. Mixon is doing.
Yeah.
Unless there's some dinner or something, and then I adjust during the week. But boy, I can tell on those days that I have a big dinner or I have a dinner when I haven't for a while, and it's like, ugh, I feel yucky.
Yeah.
I feel yucky.
Yeah.
But I wake up feeling better when I have done the intermittent
fasting. I'm not obsessive. I eat in the evening if I'm at a business dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got mm-hmm. five or six
social
people
events,
around
yeah.
the table, and, you know, everybody is eating, and they expect you to participate, and I eat. I try to eat kind of lightly on those nights.
Right.
You know, although that's probably the only time in my life I get a steak.
There you go.
Because my wife thinks that eating a great big slab of meat is barbaric, but that's the Chinese view.
Mm.
Shall we transition to the ivermectin question?
Yes. So is that helpful with you for the intermittent fasting, Todd? Did you have any more questions on that topic?
That's very good. I got it from reading a book called The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen, I think.
Dr. Bredesen does a very nice job with that.
In fact, Dr. Mixon went to meet with Dale after he published his first data. What was it, 2014?
2014, like in September.
September, right.
Yeah. And I immediately hopped on a plane and headed down to the Buck Institute.
Now ivermectin.
Well, it's kind of fascinating considering all the canceling and censoring done around ivermectin, because there are now two interesting studies, one on breast cancer and one on colon cancer, showing that ivermectin is probably useful for at least adjunctive care. That it makes the normal chemotherapies for these two cancers far more effective.
Okay.
That it interferes with the autophagocytic process and causes the cancer cells to die instead of replacing themselves.
Okay.
And makes the chemotherapy far more effective for both of these. Now, it has not yet been approved by the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
But, the studies are starting to show up, and I think you just showed me one here that says can suppress ovarian cancer by regulating the RNA mechanism. So yes, so ivermectin appears to be an anti-cancer drug that is useful in therapy for breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and now ovarian cancers. Mm-hmm. So this is this is quite interesting. Now, it takes more than a few little studies like these for the FDA to make it an indication. So it is not yet a formal indication, but there are now studies showing that it's probably going to be quite useful for a wide variety of cancers. Is that
right? It's interesting. It's difficult to get it, though. Nobody will prescribe it.
That's right, because the state... You know, the morons that are political appointees on the boards and commissions in the state are afraid you're going to use it for COVID, And heaven forbid you should take something they disapprove of. So, you know, they don't really give a damn about the the science. They've got a political agenda. And you have to remember, our medical boards are not selected based on merit or qualifications. They're political appointees. And so they're good politicians. That doesn't make them good doctors. And it doesn't make them knowledgeable about the research. So, but they have the power. And they can destroy a doctor's profession. They can take away his license, so he has no way to feed his family. They can do the same thing to the pharmacists. And so, you know, it's kind of like the old medieval might makes right. Whoever's the strongest is the one favored by God. And since they have the power, everybody is afraid to cross them. And so if you want to keep feeding your family, you stay in your profession, you shut up and do what you're told.
That's awful, isn't it? That's just very sad.
It is. It is. You know, but it's just the opposite of what they say, but it's what they do. And what they do, you know, is far more telling to the people that have to, you know, suffer under their power than anything they say.
So how did you find out about it? Did you just read it, or did somebody mention it?
I'm reading my sister-in-law has ovarian cancer, as mentioned, and I'm reading everything I can about this. And, you know, listening to your thing about testosterone, maybe that'd be good for her. And she lives in Montana, so I'm not sure what's available to her there. A little rural town called Anaconda. And so I'm just kind of wondering, just anything I can get. I pull up online or anything I can find. I'm just looking for ways to help her out.
Sure. Well, and that is good of you. Mm-hmm. You know, but what she needs is a doctor who's willing to help her out. And, you know, is willing to use the latest data to do what needs to be done, instead of, you know, ignoring the needs of real life patients whose lives are on the line.
Yeah. And again, you know, in this article, they haven't really talked about the drug regimen or frequency of dosing or anything else. So you'll have to talk to some oncologist to see if they know anything about it.
And the best way to do is you get the doctor to contact the research people at the university. You know, the doctor can go on PubMed and pull down the papers, and those papers then have the contact information for the people doing the research. And the doc then should contact the research people and discuss it with them. You know, and then if the patient, if they're going to do something that is outside of the usual and customary standard of care, should be told and informed that, hey, this is, you know, not yet approved procedures by the FDA, but these are drugs that are being written off label, which is legal, you know, and they, you know, you pays your money, you takes your chances. So that's just the way the real world works when you're on the cutting edge.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love your show. Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
All right. Take care, sir. Bye-bye.
Just a reminder, happy Memorial Day weekend from all of us at Leading Edge Medicine. All right, we are headed to Buckley. Bob is on the line. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Yes. So my wife has recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, and I called in last week, and you put me on to Dr. Rebecca Glaser in Dayton, and she uses testosterone plus an aromatase inhibitor in a pellet form. And
that's
I
right.
looked at some of those articles that I could Google, and she had really, really remarkable results. And
yes,
so
she
it
did.
Occurred to me that I've heard you speak of, you know, the testosterone in women should be 3 times the estrogen level. And I believe with longevity, you do try to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed to me that this might be, you know, an alternative to the pellets, because you can, the only place it seems to do that is in Dayton. We're in Seattle, and I was wondering if the same thing could be accomplished through your clinic. And do you do that with injections or pills or creams?
We use transdermal creams. Yeah, we use transfer frames. Now, the thing with the pellets, though, it's fascinating. The blood levels on those with those pellets is actually up in the lower end of male levels. They are actually kicking those blood levels higher than we normally take them, just because that's the nature of the pellets. So, yes, Dr. Glazier started this. She's published several papers. There's also a doctor, I think his name is Donovan, out of in Georgia. Mm. It's kind of fascinating. I was a little confused at first. I thought he was in Texas because the study that he was the head of was done in Texas. But it turns out his daughter runs a hormone clinic in Texas. Mm. So he's on the faculty research in Georgia, but he then used his daughter in Texas to do the study. But he has also a very large group of breast cancer in midlife women.
Right.
In fact, his studies were twice the size of Dr. Glazier's.
Wow.
But his focus was on preventing breast cancer. Mm. And Dr. Glazier's does both prevention and then therapy, too. So, you know, she's more global in her approach.
Right, right. So just to be clear, we don't actually do pellets right now. We have talked about it, and maybe we will in the future. Mm-hmm. And also, we don't implant them with aromatase inhibitors in the breast tissue like she does in her studies.
Yeah, because, you know, our focus is not on, we are not oncologists. Our focus is not on the therapy of cancer. Our focus is on preventing it so women never get breast cancer.
Right. So if you do have cancer, then we will need you to be under the care of your oncologist and to follow their direction. And their lead usually is no hormone replacement therapy. And that's just, you know, a blanket statement.
Right. Although we had a patient, it wasn't actually
a patient.
We
had more than one, actually, Jerry.
Yeah, yes, that have actually contacted Dr. Glazier's office. And I know of one that has actually flown to Ohio to be under their care. Now, Dr. Glazier is backing out of clinical care. She's doing more and more research and less clinical medicine. But I understand she's got some colleagues that are using her techniques, you know, in that institution. So, and I don't know anybody local that is using her technology.
No, I don't either. But what I do know is local here, you know, at Fred Hutch, Swedish, and other places, I've had patients that are under the care of radiologist, oncologist, and they will allow them to use hormones. So it's a matter of what the lesion is, where is it, what are their treatment protocols. And sometimes we can engage actively, and sometimes we have to back off.
Yep.
So it just depends upon the patient and the oncology team.
We never argue with your oncologist.
Right.
Because that's their specialty, and it's their patient, you know. So, but our forte is I don't want women to ever get breast cancer.
Right, right.
And so, and we have the capacity to drop the risk of breast cancer dramatically.
Yeah.
And the younger we start them, the lower the risk we can give them. And so that's just, you know, I consider a woman getting breast cancer a terrible a failure of the system, because we now have data that shows us that we can reduce that risk by about 85% or more, depending on when we get in to treat women.
Is that due to the testosterone-estrogen balance you try to achieve with the creams?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
You know, a woman who has never had any hormones of any kind, if you look at 100,000 woman years, you know, that, or if you look at 10,000 women for 10 years, you'll see 32 breast cancers. If those women were on testosterone, you see 5 breast cancers instead of 32. Okay. So a dramatic reduction in the incidence of breast cancer. And the really fascinating thing to me is that in those 10-year studies, we know that when a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, she didn't just get it. That cancer has been there on average about 5 years, because it started as one cell, one tiny cell. And in 30 to 90 days, it doubled, you had 2 cells. And then another 30 to 90 days, you had 4 cells. But you have to get a lump with millions and millions of cells for it to be big enough for you to even find the tumor. So the average woman has had her cancer for at least 5 years when it's diagnosed. when I look at those studies, they use the testosterone on these midlife women. 90% of the cancers that were found in those women were found in the first 4.5 years. Mm. That tells us that even though the overall incidence dropped from 32 to 50, 90% of that 50 probably already had the cancer before they started on the testosterone.
Wow.
Okay. And so the incidence of women who started with a new cancer during that period was like 1 or 2 instead of 300 or instead of 32. I mean, that's mind-boggling that we can essentially eradicate breast cancer if we will restore women to their normal youthful hormone levels early enough in life. But, you know, when should we be starting them? Well, I started my wife at 28. And the reason is simple. You don't go from healthy cells to cancer. You know, it's progression. You start off with healthy cells, and then at some point, as the hormone levels are declining and inflammation is taking its place, and they're getting fatter in part because their anabolic hormone load is low, you get inflammation, and that inflammation triggers abnormal cells begin to form. They're not cancer yet, but they're not truly normal. And over the years, those cells get worse and worse and worse, and then at some point, they make the transition to a malignancy. And then 3 to 5 years later, it's big enough for us to find it. But the process probably actually started not 5 years before we discovered it. The process probably started 15 or 20 years before, because you were going through these dysplastic stages before forming cancer. So if I had my druthers, I'd be measuring the hormone levels on every woman in America in their 30s. And I would be intervening then with little tiny doses, little steps like we've done with my wife over the last 20 years, and never let them get that hormone deprivation state that seems to be the trigger for the mutations that trigger the cancers.
Mm-hmm. Do the creams contain testosterone plus estrogen, and you monitor that to keep the ratio?
We usually use separate creams. We'll use a testosterone cream, an estrogen cream, and the estrogens depend on which estrogens we're using. We can use estradiol, which is the natural young woman's hormone, but we can also use estriol, which is actually an anti-cancer estrogen for women that have had a breast cancer in the past. We then use progesterone creams if we can keep their levels where we want them with the cream, although some women we have to use a progesterone pill, a micronized progesterone pill. So we use three separate there. We use dehydroepiandrosterone is a pill. We use the pregnenolone, which is a pill. If their thyroid is declining, as many older people are, we use low thyroid, which is a pill. So we use a combination of pills and creams depending on what the individual needs. And we monitor that person every 3 months, and we make adjustments. You know, because life happens. Sometimes you're physically active. Sometimes you're sedentary. Sometimes you're under stress. Sometimes you're not. And always you're getting older over time. And so those glands are getting older. And so, you know, this is not a one and done. This is a matter of monitoring people closely year after year after year to keep them as strong, fast, lean, smart, sexy, and healthy as possible, as long as possible in life.
So if I'll circle back to my original question again.
Sure.
But having breast cancer and starting on the hormone therapy that you provide,
yep,
could in principle accomplish the same thing as the pellets. Am I making a leap there that's inappropriate?
Okay, well, two different things. Could it in principle? Yes. I mean, I can give you blood levels, you know, anywhere I want them, okay? I mean, I keep my levels at the level of a healthy 25-year-old, athletic, robust, you know, male. I could do the same thing to my wife, but that would be abnormal because a woman's testosterone is 3 times that of her estrogen, but it's 1/12 of an age-match male. So you keep the women in the nice range for women generally. And when they're treating the cancer, they kick those levels up higher. They kick them up into the lower range of a man because they're no longer trying to prevent cancer. They're trying to treat it. And so, yes, we could, but we don't, because we don't treat cancers. We are not oncologists.
Yeah, understood. Now, but what's the advantage of the pellet then? It seems like creams are kind of easy as opposed to implanting a pellet subcutaneously. Okay.
Yeah, and I like the creams as opposed to shots or pellets, but I'm getting a signal that we're supposed to take a break, so we'll tell you what, we'll take that break, and I'll be right back, and I'll explain to you why I use the creams, but the advantages and disadvantages of the pellets.
Okay? All right, we'll talk about that in just a moment when we come back from this break. And John, you and John, hang on the line. We'll try to get to your questions as well. We'll be right back with more Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment. So glad you've tuned in to Leading Edge Medicine. Of course, it's Memorial Day weekend. We just want to wish you all the best this weekend. We've actually recorded the show in advance. We hope you're enjoying it, and we'll be back live with you next week. Yes. Okay, back to Bob.
All right, Bob.
Pros and cons of the pellets.
Of the pellets as opposed to the creams.
Okay.
Because of what we do, and because we are not treating cancers, we're trying to keep things within a healthy physiologic range. The advantage of the cream is that by changing the dose on any given day, I can change your blood levels. You know, the half-life of estrogen is about 6 hours. The half-life of testosterone is about 75 minutes, an hour and 15 minutes. So if I wash off the creams, a woman will have half of her estrogen out of her system in 6 hours. She'll have half of the testosterone out of her system in an hour and 15 minutes. So we have the ability to make rapid changes in the blood levels of our patients. And I like that, you know, because when we first start you, we don't know how well you're going to absorb the cream. We don't know how you're going to respond. And so if we're getting reactions we don't want, we can moderate. We can either increase or decrease the blood levels very quickly and very easily by adjusting the amount of the hormone in the cream, the amount of the cream applied, the surface area it's applied to, and which surface area. Because some skin is thick and poorly blood supplied, and other is very thin and richly blood supplied. And so their absorption, you know, changes by where you put it. With a pellet, you put it in and it's there. And it's there for 3 to 6 months. You know? And so you start off with a big robust level, and then it slowly over the several months, depending on how the pellet is made and what doses are in it, it will be absorbed into your bloodstream, and then you simply put in a new pellet at the end. That doesn't allow you to make rapid adjustments. You put it in, you're stuck with whatever that person absorbs until you put in the next one. And you've got a little minor surgical procedure. You've got scarring. You've got adhesions. If you're putting them in the same place over and over, you get more and more scar tissue and formation there. So you get less absorption over time. So you have to keep moving it. And now you get a whole series of little scars where you're making the incision and putting the pellets in. Now, if I were, you know, Dr. Glazer, and I'm doing this for cancer, I don't give a damn about, you know, little scars for these. But if I'm doing them for a woman who, you know, is going to be with us for 20 years and we're trying just to keep her healthy, well, then the number of scars I put on her body matters, right? So, you know, there are pros and cons. The nice thing about the pellets is once you put it in, it's in. You don't have to do anything else. You know the patient's going to be compliant for at least that 3 to 6 month period because they don't have a choice. It's in. It's being absorbed. You know, there's no way they can screw it up. Whereas the creams, well, they're dependent on people actually using them as directed. Does that answer your question?
Do they monitor themselves on a, you know, a daily basis, or do you go into the clinic? I would assume you'd have to go to the clinic, draw blood, and do an analysis. Yeah.
And that's why we do it. If people are doing well if we treat a person and they're doing great and they're happy and everything's going swimmingly, we check them about every 3 months. But if they have any problems, they come in and we check them right then. You know, the advantage, the reason I put in my own lab is that it costs me very little to do the test. And so I don't charge extra. Your monthly fee includes as much lab work as you need for anything that we can do in our lab. My rule is if I have to pay for it, you have to pay for it. But if it's done in my lab where the increased cost is nominal, then it's just included with your fee. So, you know, I can bring you in 2 weeks and check it every week for a while until I'm sure it's where I want it. And I don't have to charge you any extra for it. If I'm sending it out to a commercial lab, there are a lot of money, hundreds of dollars every time we do it. And, you know, that adds up. So I'm trying to save my patients money and let them have as much lab as they want without having to run up the cost of care. Is that
okay? And maybe Fred Hutch, or you'd have to have your oncologist's permission to be able to do hormone plus the standard of care.
That's right, yes. And some of the oncologists are just fine with it, and some are much more hesitant. And so, you know, it all depends on the particular oncologist. And so whoever's caring for you, they're in charge of this part of you. You know, it's their specialty, and we're not going to argue with them. But if it's an oncologist who says, yes, go ahead and do the hormones, and many do, we say, fine, then let's go. But if the oncologist says no, then the answer is no, as long as you're under the care of that oncologist.
Yeah, well, that honestly, it sounds like a viable option to stay local and to do it through longevity. Honestly, that's what it sounds like to me. But thank you for all that information and answering all the questions.
You're welcome, sir. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. And time for one more call today. And if we don't get to your call, we'll have our producer give you a phone number so you can be on our next program. All right. We're going to head to North Bend. We have John on the line. Hi there, John. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I was recently diagnosed with prostate cancer. My PSA started out in February 17, a 0.7. 3 years, it doubled to 1.4. About approximately 2 years, it doubled 2.8.
Oops.
In June of 2023, it went to 4.4. And my doctor started me on an herb. I forget the name of it off the top of my head.
Okay.
And I took that for a year, saw palmetto.
Mm-hmm.
I took that for 6 months, and it did no change. I went to a urologist. He decided to do we did an MRI, a biopsy, and it turned out to be positive for prostate cancer.
Uh-huh.
With a Gleason score of 7.
Okay.
So he gave me 3 options, basically wait, which I kind of already have done over the last year, radiation or surgery. My curiosity is there a fourth option? And I'm 56 years old, too, in pretty good health. So I'm kind of leaning towards surgery just to eliminate this whole factor. But thinking is maybe there's a fourth option.
Yeah, there are several options. I mean, statistically, a Gleason 7 prostate cancer has about a 93% chance of not progressing over the course of the next 12 to 15 years. So the watchful waiting and just monitoring it is something that many urologists are opting to do now for that 93%. However, there's that other 7% that it's going to grow.
In fact, I'm surprised that they moved so quickly for you and did an MRI and a biopsy, because usually I'm finding it very hard. Our patients are not able to get in that quickly. They go, well, wait and watch, we'll wait and watch, we'll wait and watch, and years go by.
That's right. So, but when I see a PSA double in a year or less, my antenna go up. I get worried. Because that says something's changing pretty fast. And if it doubles and then doubles again the next year and doubles again the next year, I'm saying, whoa, wait a minute. This is the hallmarks of a rapidly growing tumor that has a lot more chance of being aggressive. So you know, your story of these doubling, that does worry me. So you might be in that 7% that, you know, that is of concern.
I spoke to a surgeon last week for a consultation. So the urologist and a separate surgeon both said they would recommend surgery.
Mm. Yeah. Now the question, you know, is what and how? And there are a variety of things. Now there are in fact some interesting procedures now. There's one that our doctors were just kind of passing notes around to each other this past week. A procedure in which they're using focused ultrasound, and they're actually just going in through the penis, no incision, dropping these little ultrasound probes down strategically around the tumor that they've localized with the MRI, and then basically destroying that portion of the prostate that has the cancer in it. And the side effects of incontinence and problems with sexual function and stuff were extremely low. So that was a fascinating paper. It's a very new procedure. They don't have large numbers on it. But boy, I was looking at it thinking, ooh, if my prostate starts to act up, that's one I might seriously consider. Mm. There are a variety of approaches these days.
Right. But Jerry, remember, he's a Gleason 7. He's 56 years old, so he's very young, and he doesn't want spread. He doesn't want it to grow. He doesn't want it to get out of the prostate.
Yep.
And so for him, his choice is, yes, they're his decision, but, you know, depends on his mentality. And if it has grown so quickly in this last little year or two.
And that's what has worried me.
He wants it out. He doesn't want metastatic disease. He doesn't want to deal with radiation and radiation problems and seed problems.
Yeah, I understand. But again, you've got the proton that will let you do the entire process. And this other procedure now, they are doing the entire prostate.
Yeah.
With very little risk to the surrounding tissues and virtually no damage to the urethra and the bladder. So there are some interesting stuff out there.
Right.
That I would be looking at pretty hard, as opposed to many of the traditional that do have a significant impact on your sexuality and your bladder and bowel function.
So, indeed. Yeah. And, you know, again, if you were 10, 20 years older, you may have chosen something differently. Now your big thing is, okay, it's a cancer. I want it out. Mm-hmm. I don't want it inside me, and I don't want it to spread.
Right.
So
how many side effects are you willing to accept?
Absolutely.
To do that?
Wow. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm getting signals here that are saying, quit.
We have a minute left of our show.
Yeah.
Why don't you call us on the other show?
Yep. Call us on the next show and we'll chat about it a bit more, okay?
Yeah. John, go ahead and ask the producer
for
the phone number and he will give you that, okay?
We'll take you right away.
Okay, thank you.
Because this is important.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Lots of questions today again, which we like. We like a variety of lots of people listening will be going, oh, I know somebody with this, or oh, that's me. We invite you always to call in. We are live again in the studio next weekend, and we would love to have you call in if you didn't get through today. And John in North Bend, John in Tacoma, I hope you'll call our other show and we'll get you in right away. Have a great rest of your weekend. Enjoy those springtime flowers and those springtime showers that are coming with them. And we will be back with you next time. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.